I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, the 2020 Tour de France turned out to be one of the best in living memory. Unpredictable from stage one, well, to stage 21 with attacking, audacious riding and surprises round a majority of corners. And every day on the road, you could see the changing of the guard, a new generation of young riders coming to the front in the mountains, in the sprint finishes and on the podiums. So as the dust settles from 3,500 kilometres of racing, we'll be talking through some of the highlights and the lessons. And we'll also be focusing on some of the highlights of the latest edition of Rouleur magazine 20.6, still available on subscription, but only if you're quick. This is Rouleur Conversations, supported by Lacquer, bicycle insurance, powered by the community. So after all the uncertainty, the Tour de France was a cracker. Here to discuss it are executive editor Ian Cleverley and Daniel Stewart, who's written a fascinating article in the current Rouleur about his short but intense career in the pro peloton. Now, Ian, first of all, it was a great race, wasn't it?
It certainly was. I mean, I tweeted halfway through the mountain time trial mountain time trial, it's just like a time trial, but slower, because I was just kind of like drifting off. And then
everything happened.
Yeah, and then everything happened, and what we witnessed was pretty extraordinary stuff. But I mean, I just enjoyed kind of every stage, really. There must have been one or two stages that I didn't find where there was something really interesting going on, some great dynamic, some brilliant young rider doing something extraordinary. Mark Hershey, I thought, was fantastic. So many good things to take away from it. Really enjoyable.
And the masks and the lack of crowds and all the other stuff didn't really seem to make much of an impact, did they?
No, but, I was quite conflicted on that, because I was really surprised that they actually allowed so many people to be by the side of the road. I don't know if got away with it is the right words to use in this instance, but it seems that they got away with it.
We'll probably see in a month or so, won't we? But there was always uncertainty about whether the Tour went ahead, and every day there was some sort of speculation about whether they'd reach Paris. But do you think that changed the way that the teams and the riders approached it?
Maybe. But I don't know if it was just that the route kind of lent itself to that kind of approach anyway. There's so many kind of lumpy, bumpy stages as opposed to flat stages or mountain stages. But you may have a point. No, I mean, the way Sunweb raced it was just fantastic. They were an absolute revelation. Really enjoyed that.
Now, Daniel Stewart, I presume you know Sam Bennett or have raced against him in the past.
Yeah, I knew of him. We never really lived together or anything, and we sort of bumped into each other, representing Ireland and stuff. But yeah, definitely I knew him, and his godparents, live in Belgium, and they actually allowed me to stay in their house from time to time when I was racing in Belgium. So yes, I've definitely been a big Sam Bennett fan for a while. I suppose the Tour is just amazing to see that. I think he really deserves that jersey, and I think just being within the Irish press and just seeing how he's becoming a household name just puts goosebumps in my arms. So I don't know what it means for him, but just to see when I was growing up what Sean Kelly is, that's what Sam Bennett is now to the younger generations growing up in Ireland. So yeah, I think it's amazing, but so well deserved.
One of the things he has said is that he hopes it does kind of inspire another generation in the way that Stephen Roche and Sean Kelly did. But there is a new generation, isn't there? Because the likes of Eddie Dunbar and Ryan Mullen are doing really well. And you know both of them as well, don't you? You race with both of them.
Yeah, definitely. I would know them a good bit better there. I think Eddie's 1 year younger than me and Mullen's the same age as me. I think what's amazing about that group of riders is that, in my opinion, they've done it all on their own. You know, they've just been fantastic talents from the get-go. You know, when I was racing with them, I remember Mullen turning up at my first race and just him destroying everyone. It was a criterium and he just lapped the whole field. It is amazing to have that Irish talent. But I think what personally I hope with Bennett's success is that, you know, Cycling Ireland are able to get a support to, you know, get a velodrome in Ireland. Like if you think of Martin Irvine, he's a track world champion and he was able to do that without a velodrome being in Ireland. You know, we've managed to achieve so much without the facilities. So hopefully this is, you know, the facilitator to get the likes of, you know, a proper velodrome in, to, you know, proper funding, a talent team that can rival the likes of Team GB in the past. And, you know, that's what I would love to see in the next, you know, 5-10 years off the back of this massive success for Sam.
Because there are outdoor velodromes in the north and the south, but no indoor velodrome anywhere on the island of Ireland, are there?
Yeah, so we've got Orangefield up north in Belfast, actually like 5 minute walk from the school I used to go to, but it needs a new surface. It wouldn't be like the Herne Hill Velodrome, which is, you know, a lot smoother. It's very rough, and I know it's significantly more expensive to resurface a track over, you know, just a normal road. And then you've got Sundrive in Dublin, which is a lot better, but again, you know, it is outdoor and you're restricted when it starts raining. And, you know, we'll address the elephant in the room, we're not in Marbella, we're in, you know, city side in Dublin, so, you know, rain is a factor. So, you know, I was, you know, training with the track team in Mallorca when I was cycling. We would go to Palma Velodrome and we would, you know, train in the morning on the road and then go to the track. And then, you know, when we finish up at like 6 or 7 in the evening, you would have, you know, 30 to 50 Spanish kids who are like 5 to 8 years old, and they're going up on a velodrome, which is, you know, just going around it, and, you know, they're skidding about on it, and just the control and the confidence they had was like over and above what we had, and we were like trying to train for the team pursuit. So if we were able to replicate that in Ireland, not only is it going to make like just another thing for like the youth of Ireland to do and form their life around, and it's going to, you know, bring sport and success as well.
So turning to your article in Rouleur 20.6, which is a great article and beautifully illustrated as well, and how does a kid from East Belfast end up wanting to be a pro racing cyclist?
Good question. I mean, that's probably a motivator of what made me write it, because I don't really know still now. I don't know, I think from a young age I always wanted to do something different, and I wanted to, you know, it's probably like a factor of wanting to always be in control, but I wanted to have full control of my life. And, you know, my mom and dad, they've done very well for themselves in, you know, they both came from working class backgrounds, and they've worked their way up to provide me and my older brother, you know, a middle class background. But, you know, growing up, I was sort of looking at them and thinking, you know, they've got boring office jobs. I don't want the boring office job. I love sport. My dad was always into sport and into motorbikes, and my mom was very committed in not getting me on a motorbike. So I suppose cycling became the safer option in her eyes. That's sort of what progressed me onto it. Then I suppose when I was, you know, 15 or 16, I was still playing rugby in school, and then I decided, you know, not to, as people started going to the gym and getting a bit bigger up top. And that's when I made the decision, you know, I want to do cycling. And I think I tap into that in the piece, you know, that trip to the Northern Irish Championships. Like, that is just an iconic moment in my life that happened, where I was like, I don't want to, you know, just make up the numbers here. I want to be the best at this. And I think that's where, you know, that sort of passion was born, to try and achieve that. And then as that sort of happened, you know, loads of other factors of, you know, just being a teenager and being, you know, an outcast and, you know, trying to be a cyclist while everyone else is playing rugby or football and stuff like that sort of factored in, and then not really getting along with teachers and stuff. So when I got to like my A levels and really wasn't sure about going to university at all, I was like, well, the thing I'm absolutely sure about is that I love to ride my bike. So why not just do that? You know, keep it simple and see what happens.
And you did the sort of traditional thing, didn't you, that you raced in Belgium and then eventually raced in France?
Yeah, so where I'm from in Belfast, there's a guy called Danny Blondel. He's originally from Belgium, but he lives in Northern Ireland now, and he set up a foundation called the Belgium Project of getting Northern Irish riders into Belgium and just racing there. And that's where I met Sabine and Rick, Sam's godparents, and they're able to bring me into their house. You know, I give them a little bit of money, not a lot at all, for what they did for me. And they would bring me to all the races, you know, which are every day, feed me, give me a place to sleep. And then I was doing that, you know, during my summer holidays. And then as I got older, I started going there more regularly when I should be revising for exams. I got the bug there, and that's what, you know, kept me in Belgium. But Belgium is very flat. It's very, it's extremely hard racing, but it's for, you know, it's for sprinters, it's for classic riders, unless you're in the Ardennes or something like that. So I thought, you know, I need to get myself to France and see what it's like there. And obviously I explained that in the piece of how, you know, that sort of racing suited, you know, my type of riding a lot better. And, you know, that's what led me there. And, you know, I got, you know, a little bit of success. I did quite well, you know, a couple of races, which eventually led me to Ampostian Reaction.
And from what you write about those early days, I mean, it's relatively recent, but it still sounds like the sort of stories that Stephen Roche and Sean Kelly would be telling about their early days on the continent. Not much has changed, has there, as a sort of way in?
From an Irish perspective, yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, that's what I was sort of trying to say about, you know, Mullen, Dunbar and Bennett. They've went a similar route to me. They've done it all themselves. Which I think is a fantastic acumen to them. But I think if we could get to a position where, you know, you don't have to do that yourself, you know, you've got, you know, Cycling Ireland are backing you and...
You've got some sort of academy or...
Yeah, some sort of camp. I know, you know, when I was cycling, Cycling Australia had their camp in Italy. I know Team GB, they've got a camp in New York, I think, and I'm sure they've got other ones. If Cycling Ireland were to have a proper one like that, I think it would mean so much because, you know, although that was, you know, it's an amazing adventure for me, looking back, the amount of pressure I was putting myself under because I was so responsible for every single part of my life as like a, you know, just a kid, really. I think it would just, you know, you get a lot more people who, you know, don't do what I did and, you know, just quit. If you alleviate that pressure from the rider, you know, they're going to perform better.
And without wanting to spoil the article, why did you give up?
Again, good question. Who really knows? I don't know. Again, I think it's just if you were to know me, I'm probably a pretty bossy person. I suppose that comes from wanting to be, again, you know, totally in control. So I think what was happening as I got more into the pro style of racing, I realized that I wouldn't be in control and, you know, that wasn't going to change anytime soon. That's probably a fundamental reason. And it's the same with any continental rider, really. I wasn't really getting paid a lot. My dad was really great and supported me in any way he could. But, you know, I felt so much pressure to try and support myself and I just felt I wasn't, you know, getting that. It's not a regret to me. You know, I think it was such an amazing experience and to make it as a pro and maybe for it not to work out has been an amazing preparation for my life and has made me the person I am today. But yeah, definitely read the article and find out exactly why.
And you can read Daniel's article in the current edition of Rouleur. And you'll get it free if you subscribe. Go to the website and use the code MAVERICKS, as in I feel the need for speed. And a subscription is really worthwhile because you get a whole year of brilliant cycling journalism. But don't take my word for it, though. Listen to the voice of the tour.
Now then, here's an infomercial message for the discerning folk of Rouleurland. For the finest long-form cycling journalism and exquisite photography and design, why don't you simply subscribe to Rouleur magazine? It costs as little as £7 per month. Regular columnists include Orla Shenoui, Romain Bardet and me, Ned Bolting, accompanied by features from the best writers and photographers in the business. Simply go to Rouleur.com. rouleurland.cc. You know it makes sense.
That's Nib Bolting, who I think, along with David Miller, had a really good tour in challenging circumstances. You're listening to Rouleur Conversations, brought to you by Lacquer, bicycle insurance powered by the community.
So my name is Oren Peleg, and I'm an investor in Lacquer. Three things that really caught my eye. The first one is they're looking to change the insurance industry, which is a very large industry and I think needs change. The second thing is I'm deeply passionate about getting people on two wheel. We need to address our congestion and pollution crisis, and I believe that two wheels have a massive role to play in that. And the third thing is I can see a growing trend around companies building on the strong communities that they have. And I think Lacquer's business model in the way they tap into the community of cyclists is something that's very much on trend at the moment.
This is Rouleur Conversations. I'm Ian Parkinson, and with me are executive editor Ian Cleverly and writer Daniel Stewart. Ian, also in Rouleur 20.6, there's also a lovely photo feature by Paolo Martelli about L'Eroica, not just the Italian ones, but all the other ones from the franchise. That's a bit of a departure for Rouleur, isn't it? It's a road racing magazine and covering what is basically a very photogenic sportive.
It is a bit, yeah. We reached this conclusion like a couple of months back, and we're always just kind of covering pro bike racing to the exclusion of anything else. And we just feel like we're sort of cutting our nose off to spite our face somewhat. So we're just gently widening our remit. And I mean, I've known Paolo for years, and he's been photographing the L'Eroica for years. It's always just extraordinary, beautiful work. And we just thought, you know, why not?
Yeah, and I spoke to Paolo about his involvement in L'Eroica.
I started in 2015. So more or less every year I follow around, I think, 7-8 events around the world. Let's suppose 7 events each year per 5. It's 35, maybe.
And we always think of L'Eroica as being in Tuscany on the Strade Bianche, but it's all over the world now, isn't it?
Well, the original one is just one. That is at the beginning of October, and it's in Gaiole. And that's where everything began, like 22 years ago. Then when the big sponsors came in, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, they wanted to, you know, spread all the, well, the brand and the event around the world. So actually, they wanted one in every continent, I think. That's the goal. And just Australia is missing, because Japan is in California. There was one in South America and then South Africa. So just Australia is missing.
As a photographer, what's the appeal of L'Eroica?
If I think about a normal race, like pro race, this is quite relaxing for me, because I don't have to follow any, there's no winner. I just decide what to do by, you know, riding the race or with a motorbike. And whenever I see something that I do like, I just stop and wait. It's nothing about, you know, competing and winning. So you see people of all kinds just riding because they love it, or they used to ride, or they used to be pro. So, but that doesn't matter. They're just there to ride with friends and enjoy. It is actually landscape in the landscape in Tuscany is it's just amazing. So it's a pain. That's not good for me, because it's so easy to do nice pictures. It's harder to do bad picture, I think.
And it's not just the landscape, though, is it? Because the faces are what make many of the pictures in Rouleur in particular.
Yeah, the faces and probably the eyes also. The moments in general. Most of these people, they don't ride during the year, so they're not trained. They decide just to do, on that day, 200Ks. So it's kind of a hero thing. I mean, it's hard. 209Ks with, I don't know, maybe 4,000 meter
when they arrive and the families, they're waiting for them, it's beautiful. I don't see this that often in, you know, normal races.
Some of your pictures feature Luciano Berutti, who is instantly recognisable, was instantly recognisable. He was very much the face of L'Eroica, wasn't he?
Yeah, but that was not prepared. He just loved to ride his old bicycles. Like 20 years ago, he just started to look for this kind of event around Italy. There was no one. But then he discovered L'Eroica, and he just loved to go there and try to do the big one, the big loop with his old bikes, because he was so much in love with the old cyclist. He was always telling us stories about the first time he saw, you know, the Giro passing close to his house, and all this, you know, colorful peloton with old bikes. So he was always saying, if they did this, well, we can still do this. And instantly he became, yeah, probably the image of L'Eroica. But at first years, there was no, you know, official photographer. So when I started as official, I think it was a coincidence maybe, but we just got close friends together and we started to travel together. And yeah, I mean, he became the image of L'Eroica, but he didn't want to.
Yeah, he was so recognizable. But I think a lot of people may not know, he was actually a very good rider, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. I think he won around 16 Italian cyclocross championship during his life. Actually, his technique was quite good. He never rode like road racing, but all mountain bikes and cyclocross, he was crazy good. Actually, his skills on his old bike, 1907, I think, they were just great, with no brakes almost.
Yeah, no brakes and old tires and single gear, but he still managed to ride it, didn't he?
Yeah. He was impressive.
What next, Paolo? When is the next L'Eroica that you're going to photograph? I imagine the schedule has been disrupted a bit.
Yeah, this year it was complicated, so we missed 90% of the L'Eroicas. We had one in Germany at the end of August. There was no permission for the original L'Eroica at the beginning of October because too many people. You regroup around 30,000 people in a small village, and that's impossible this year. So the only one outside of Italy was Germany, and then we had one in Montalcino 2 weeks ago, around 1,000 people. And then the next one is Nova L'Eroica at the end of October. And that's it for 2020.
Well, hopefully next year will be better, and continue to keep taking the pictures, and we'll enjoy them in Ruleur.
Yeah, hope so. Thank you.
Paolo Martelli. So the tour's over. The Giro's next, in theory at least, although who knows what can happen. Any thoughts about the Giro in the light of the tour?
Well, I can say from an Irish perspective, I don't think I'm going to see Eddie Dunbar because he broke his collarbone at Tirreno, unfortunately. I don't know, it's all coming so thick and fast. I just like feel like I'm just taking a breath after the end of the tour, putting the next issue to press on Thursday, and then I got to start thinking about the Giro, but I haven't even had a chance to look at it, to be honest.
It is weird the way the races are all coming, you know, one after the other.
Well, indeed. I mean, the Giro and the Vuelta overlap, don't they? And then they've got the Worlds as well. It's just like, can't keep up.
Daniel, what about you?
I think it's sort of like a selfish part of me, when they did release the new racing program, I was sort of a little bit excited because I was like, you don't have to wait for anything. It's just, you know, all you can eat, road racing, amazing. But obviously for the riders, it's going to be hard for the, you know, not this year, but next year, like how do you recover after all that? And then, you know, the normal cycling season starts in February. So, you know, are they expected to, you know, start again in 2021 in February as they normally would? So they're not going to get the same off season and the same prep. But in terms of, you know, how the Giro next week, what I really hope to happen is that they can, you know, organize it as well as the tour was. You know, obviously we can criticize the tour for certain things about, you know, the amount of crowds in certain sections of it. But I think, you know, they were really committed to being like, you know, the coronavirus, people need to adapt to it. You know, this is going to be part of our life for, you know, a significant amount of time. So I'm hoping that in Italy, you know, the same thing can occur. They don't have to pull the plug on it. That's what I'm hoping for. And just, you know, some, if the tour is anything like the tour, I think we're in for, you know, a really, really nice treat.
Well, fingers crossed. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Ian. On the subject of the young generation, of course, good to see that South London's own Ethan Hayter got his first pro win the other day in the Giro dell'Appennino in North Italy. And that's it from this Ruler Conversations. Don't forget to go to the Ruler website and subscribe to the magazine. £7 a month for the best cycling journalism and photography. There'll be a Long Reads podcast next week. Until then, take care.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.